Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance, Representative Holmes, Representative Samuels, Representative Ramirez, Representative Coghill. Representative Lynn is excused. I believe he is at his wife's. She's recovering from her surgery. Representative Gruenberg is here. First bill up is House Bill 103. Representative Holmes, would you adopt the CS, please, version E?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt CS for House Bill 103-25-LS-0401-E.
Thank you. We have CS for House Bill number 103 before us. Representative Coghill, you're going to present. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
You
have
the floor. I will do the best I can. Thank you, Chairman, for hearing this bill. Mr. Chairman, this is my attempt to delve into the court rules dealing with a civil lawsuit. And what this does with deals with the appeal bond when you're under a civil litigation. And what it does is it says if you're a company that has its assets up for judgment under a civil lawsuit and you want to appeal it, that we're going to try to limit what can be demanded. And under this particular law, we will ask that be a $5 million or 10% of the appellant's net worth. This is under the appeal process. So under current law, it's probably one of the tougher laws. Mr. Chairman, there are people that will testify on this, so I think that will help us get into the details of it. Obviously, mine is a broader philosophical debate, and that is allowing companies to go ahead and make the appeal without making them bankrupt and still have the imposition of they have to pay the damages, but this has to deal with the punitive awards, I think, in the civil, probably the bigger portion of it. And the idea is if you put somebody out of business during the appeal process, first of all, I think justice can be hampered because everybody has a right to appeal. It's also true that their ability to pay then comes into serious question. So, Mr. Chairman, this deals with limiting appeal bonds. And I think it's just a defendant's right to make an appeal shouldn't be hampered, I think, because of putting a financial burden on them that they just can't bear. To me, that's a simple part of it. As we get into this, you're going to see whenever you're dealing with several court rules that it's not that simple. I've talked to the Department of Law, and hence we have this CS in front of us that deals with court direct rule number 62 and 204 and 205.
Mr. Chairman.
I am sorry.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'm speaking on behalf of my fellow member of the Minority Caucus. We have a very important caucus right now on the supplemental budget. Minority leaders requested our presence. I have a very great interest in this bill and would request if there is a way of dealing with other items on the calendar till I can return.
Mr. Chairman, there's only one thing that I would ask. I do have somebody who is going to call in the Victor Schwartz, who is a professor who actually has written some of the textbook on this. I would ask, because of having them call in from out of state, that we go ahead and take that testimony. I'll provide it to you in writing as best I can, but I sure would like to have him here available for questions. And I'm sorry.
I'm happy to wait till he flies up, too.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Coghill. What I'd like to do is to request that one of the minority members stay here to hear that piece of testimony, and then we'll set this bill aside. These caucuses, they last a while. So would one or the other of you stay just for Mr. Schwartz's testimony?
Let us ask.
Representative Gruenberg?
Mr. Chairman, I've been told it's only going to take like 2 minutes. I don't know what that means. I've been told they need us right now for like 2 minutes.
We'll take a 5 minute at ease.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back on the record. We had extended as a courtesy of 5 minutes to the minority. Mr. Schwartz, are you with us? Mr. Schwartz?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I am. We're in the unusual position of both of our minority members went to a minority caucus They assured us they'd be back in a few minutes. Would you, do you have some time to stand by for us?
Sure. I've prepared for this and looking forward to it, so.
We will,
advise me about how long it's going to be, that's all. If you can, maybe you can.
Well, our intention is to take up another piece of legislation, and then we will put that aside and come back to 103. One of our minority members expressed a very specific interest in listening to the testimony on this.
Okay, sure.
So we're going to accommodate him. So if you'll just stand by, and at this point, Crystal, if you'll pop up here, we're going to take up House Bill 331. And if you'll introduce yourself for the record, Crystal, you know how much we enjoy having you before our committee. It's a pleasure to see you.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Roses. He extends his apologies. He is currently sitting in another committee right now.
We're good with him.
Okay, we're good. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present to you House Bill 331, which deals with motor vehicle insurance, license suspensions, and notices relating to motor vehicles. The first thing that House Bill 331 does is drops a penalty for failure to notify the DMV of a name change. Excuse me. Or address change from a Class B misdemeanor to a fine not to exceed $25. Section 2 of the bill adds an affirmative defense clause to Alaska statute that states if a person's license was suspended for failure to show proof of insurance, it is an affirmative defense that if they can prove that they did in fact have insurance at the time of the accident. And Section 2 directly relates to Section 4 of the bill. Current statute states that a person must fill out a form following a vehicle accident proving that they do in fact have insurance. And if a person fails to fill out that form, a notice is sent to the person requesting them to send in the correct paperwork. If after 30 days DMV doesn't receive the paperwork, your license is now suspended. Quite often the address that the department sends the notification to is not the address that's most current. So what Section 4 does is changes the notification process that sends the form to not only the address that they have on file, but if the form that they filled out during the accident report is the most current address, that's the address that they'll send it to. And finally, House Bill 331 adds a new section that states if a person does not have vehicle insurance, they're guilty of a Class B misdemeanor and a fine of at least $500. Currently, the only fine for driving without insurance is a license suspension of between 90 days to a year. And that's 331.
Excellent. Crystal, you did a great job of presenting that. We have Carrie Henning with the DMV is available for questions. Now, members of the committee, we heard this bill in House Labor and Commerce, and although you were very specific in a broader terms, this is like this bizarre circle. It's like when we've all visited the DMV and you wait 20 minutes to get to the front of the line, and then you get to the front of the line and say, "Oh, if you just had this one document, we'd be so happy to process it." And you go home and you get the document, and you come back and they're like, "Well, this isn't the right document. This is almost the right document." And then you go back over and over again and. I mean, this is not the specific narrative that you provided, but this is one of those very frustrating things that takes well-intentioned, law-abiding people and turns them into a corkscrew.
Yep.
And it's not the intent of the state of Alaska nor the DMV. And I'm very appreciative of this, the fix-it nature of this piece of legislation, no different than a fix-it ticket. But you can imagine if they send the notice to your last known address, and then it's a terrible thing. So are there questions for the sponsor, or are there any questions for Carrie Henning from the Department of Motor Vehicles? Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Henning, I would like to know your feelings on the bill that we have before us.
Through the chair, this is Carrie Hennings with Division of Motor Vehicles. DMV is very happy with this bill. These changes will help us with our customer service and make it much easier for people who unfortunately have been in crashes.
All right, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
It seemed to me like this bill also was brought up in the context of another bill that we had traveling through, was it last year?
Mm-hmm.
And it was reported that that they would come back with a separate piece of legislation, and so here we are. And this really just allows notification so that somebody doesn't end up getting hammered for not having insurance because the address wasn't right. So I think it's a very good piece of legislation. I'm ready to move it.
Thank you. Although we want to accord due process, this is a great fix-it bill. This is good for every Alaskan that's ever been on the receiving end of a DMV surprise. So with that, is there anybody in the audience that wants to in the room that wants to testify? There's nobody else online. Is that correct? Public, Representative Grimberg.
I do apologize.
Yes.
I didn't hear the testimony. I'm not familiar with the bill. Could we have a very brief?
Yes, Representative Grimberg. Crystal, would you please take?
I'm sorry.
Representative Grunberg back through the bill.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg. This bill addresses pretty much four different things. The first thing it changes, if you don't change your name or address and notify DMV, or if you do change your name and address, you must notify DMV within 30 days. If you do not, currently right now it's a Class B misdemeanor. We're changing that fine down to $25. We feel that's reasonable. Second section adds an affirmative defense clause. If you're in an accident and you show proof of your insurance to the police officer and to the other motorist, but you fail to send in the paperwork, you then have your license suspended. This is saying that if you do in fact prove that you had insurance at the time of the accident, that it's an affirmative defense. Section 3 deals with driving without insurance. If you drive currently, if you drive without insurance, the only fine right now imposed is a license suspension of 90 days to a year. We're changing that to a Class B misdemeanor with a fine of at least $500. And Section 4 of the bill says that the department, the form that must be filled out and sent proving that you do have insurance, the department then has the option to send it to the most recent address on file, whether that be what DMV has on record or the accident report, whichever is most current.
That's the Garra amendment, right?
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I'm interested in Section 3.
Okay. Do you mind if I close the public testimony? At this point, public testimony is closed. The matter is back before the committee. Crystal, you did a splendid job as always. Representative Grunberg.
So right now, what is the penalty for driving uninsured?
A license suspension of 90 days to 1 year. In your packet, the second to last sheet of paper in there is a printout of the mandatory insurance suspension from the DMV. And the second to last paragraph in there states what the suspension is.
So this will make it a criminal
correct
penalty also.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it will be a Class B misdemeanor. Also in your packet, Ledge Research did print out for me some of the mandatory insurance requirements of other states. Massachusetts, for example, has a fine of up to $5,000 plus 1 year in jail. Also, you know, Alabama, 6 months, you know, suspended, $500 first offense, $1,000 second. So we do not feel that we are stepping over the boundaries of what other states are doing. Plus, driving without insurance not only costs the state, but it also costs us as consumers.
So, through the chair, so this will be a minimum fine of $500, and under a Class B misdemeanor, what's the maximum fine?
I do not know.
Does anybody know what the maximum fine for a Class B misdemeanor is? Really?
My chart's disappeared from the back. Normally, I'd have it.
Yes, Randy. currently searching. Okay, and it's up to 90 days in jail. But the minimum fine will be $500, so it's the cost of insurance. Can they impose a civil penalty plus this if this bill passes?
I do not know. I can find that out for you.
Representative Grunberg, we have Ms. Henning from the DMV available to answer any questions.
Let's ask.
Ms. Henning?
Yes, this is Carrie Hennings.
Did you hear the question from Representative Grunberg?
Yes, I did. And through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there is no civil penalty that I'm aware of. We administratively just do the license suspensions.
Okay, so if, through the chair, so if this bill passes, you will do the reinstatement fee plus this. So the person will have to pay the reinstatement fee of $100 to $500 plus a fine of $500 plus the cost of insurance.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, DMV does not collect any fines from convictions. That's all through the court system.
But the total would be, as I've stated, is that correct?
There is a reinstatement fee for any license suspension or revocation.
And that's between $100 and $500?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, depending on the driving record.
Oh, it depends on the driving record.
Correct.
I see.
What Representative Grunberg, what are you trying to accomplish? Maybe the committee can assist
what
you.
What I'm trying to accomplish is to find out exactly if this passes, the person could be looking at 90 days in jail, a $2,000 fine, $500, up to a $500 reinstatement fee, plus the cost of insurance. Mm-hmm. And it could be a situation where there's no insurance because maybe the mail just hasn't reached them or something like that. And this could be very, very hard on people who are in my district. You may shake your head, but that's the case in my district.
Can I comment?
Yes, yeah, the bill's before the committee. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Grunberg, the reason I shake my head is it doesn't matter how slow the U.S. mail system is or whatever, the responsibility is on us as citizens, us as car owners, us as license holders to have the contact with our insurance companies to keep those things current. I mean, you know, as a lawyer, someone couldn't go in there and win a case because the mailman didn't deliver.
Through the chair, Grunberg. In Anchorage, don't they also impound the car? When I've gone and driven with the police in a ride along, they have impounded the car if you don't have proof of insurance with you. They take the car and then they also have to pay the fee to get the car back. Do you know if that's
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't know exactly what it said in statute, but I know it does say it's up to the municipalities to impose.
I think that's the case in Anchorage. They also take the car away, and they charge the towing fee, and they charge daily fees to get that car back. And for some people who are marginally on the margin in my district, it is impossible now to get that car back, and this is, they're going to be facing 90 days in jail plus an additional between $500 and $2,000. This will put a lot of people under.
Representative Grunberg, I see that the Department of Law is here. Would you like to have them weigh in on this issue?
She doesn't even know.
Sure. We have another lawyer here.
Representative Dahlstrom. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunberg, in the municipality of Anchorage, and that's the only one I can speak for certainty about, you are correct. They do have the ability to impound, and I know that for a fact because I have a son who learned his lesson that way, and I'm sure that he will never repeat that behavior again. Also, when we're talking about people's financial status, there's no other laws that we have that we say someone's exempt from or we need to consider this or that because of what their financial status is or isn't. I mean, the laws are in place. And as that very passionate speech that you gave on the floor the other day about people dying, when we have people that are driving without licenses, usually it's for a very good reason. And there's other factors involved. So in your own words, people are dying when people are doing this. And as far as I'm concerned, this isn't even strict enough.
I'd like to respond to that. This takes away from the court the ability, as I understand it, to suspend imposition of the $500 fee.
Okay.
And, you know, we're talking about, as I say, the cost of getting the car back, which is very considerable, the reinstatement fee with the DMV, and now you're also having this mandatory minimum, and potentially a jail term. I don't know that that would necessarily always be imposed, but what you're going to do, frankly, is people won't be able to afford this. It's going to be the same kind of a thing. The people driving with suspended licenses, they wink at the law, and they do it, and because they can't then do this and get insurance, they'll just break the law. And I think this is just going to be this one provision without the provision of if you can even suspend the $500. That's going to put a lot of people in my district, poor people, unable to drive and get to work and go to the hospital and everything else.
Your point is well made, Representative Grunberg. The intention of this, when it was brought to us by Representative Roses and Representative Guerra, who spoke very eloquently on this subject matter, was to prevent precisely what you're talking about happening to people administratively. And my recommendation would be that you offer a specific conceptual amendment now, or that you draft a piece of legislation to remedy this particular aspect of the bill in the 26th legislative session. And we're ready. We have a full agenda today, and we're ready to move on. Would you like to offer a conceptual amendment to address this?
Let me just ask you, did Representative Guerra support and speak to Section 3 of the bill, or was it Section 4?
Representative Guerra was in the room for the entire hearing on the bill in Labor and Commerce, and my understanding is, as a co-sponsor, that he participated in it. But I don't want to speak for the representative, but he's a co-sponsor of Section 3 and Section 4.
I will talk to him. I'm not going to offer anything right now.
Okay.
I am very concerned about the effect that's going to have on poor people.
It's noted in the record. Crystal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, this part of the bill that was tacked on to House Bill 184 that passed last year was voted on through the floor, passed the House, and this section of the bill was cut out from that over in the Senate. So the House members have already voted to move this out of the House.
And through the chair.
And I do believe, and I don't have it in front of me, but you were a due pass on that bill.
Representative Coghill.
I think part of the issue was, if you're going to have a hefty fine like this, then there has to be a reasonable notification effort. And I think that was the problem we had was that a revocation could happen because somebody sent it to the wrong address or could not make that. So what we did is we made them get better notification because it's right on the citation. Plus, we turned it into a fine instead of a Class B misdemeanor, which can be easily levied. So what you did was you made it so that if they have insurance, they have all these kind of rebuttable presumptions. But if they don't have it, and if they're going to drive on the roads without it, then it's going to cost them.
Through the chair. I don't recall the details. I do definitely recall the reason Section 4 is there, and it was to provide the additional notice. I don't recall the detailed history of Section 3, and that's my lapse on this. Was the mandatory minimum fine in the bill that passed the House last time? I'd ask Crystal, through the chair.
I'm not interested in what transpired in the 24th legislature. We have House Bill 331 before us. Your intention is not to offer a specific amendment. Is that correct?
That was my intention. I would like to have my question answered, if I could, since she brought it up.
Crystal.
I'm mainly interested in the mandatory $500 fine.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that was Guerra's amendment, and I do not
Representative Guerra's,
and I don't recall.
Representative Grunberg.
I'll take that up with him.
Okay. Enough said. The matter is back before the committee. The chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the CS for House Bill number 331 25-LS0972/C with attached physical note and individual recommendations.
Without objection, House Bill 331 moves from committee. At this point in time, we'll roll back up the calendar to introduction of guests. Representative Elstrom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to introduce to everybody in the committee room my million-dollar man, my husband, Kit.
Thank you,
who supports me 100% in doing this job.
Yes. All right. Back before us is House Bill 103. Mr. Schwartz, we thank you very much for holding for us. If you'll introduce yourself, any affiliation that you have, and provide your testimony.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much, Chairman Ramos and members of this committee, for inviting me. This is the first time I've ever done this by phone, so I'll need your help a little bit. By way of background, first, I'm testifying on behalf of the American Legislative Exchange Council. I serve as the council's co-chair with Senator Dillard of Illinois of the Civil Justice Task Force. I know that Representative Coghill and maybe others are members of ALEC. For a long time, I was a law professor. I'm co-author of Prosser, Wade, and Schwartz. It's a casebook that's used in most law schools. For the first 14 years of my practice, I did only plaintiff's work while I was a professor. For the past 20, I've been on the defense side. The views that I state today are on behalf of ALEC, but basically, they are my views. I became interested in appeal bonds about 15 or 16 years ago. They had been sort of arcane, really. They had been put in the law in a lot of states, and Alaska, people in Alaska would know better about how yours was put in. But in a lot of states, what happened is a person would be suing a landlord. They would win their case. The case would go on appeal. And then the landlord would dissipate the assets. He or would put it in some bogus account, and the person never could get their money. So it had a very, very legitimate purpose. Now, that was then, and now it's 2008. And you do have, on occasion, some very, very large judgments where a defendant may be unable to post an appeal bond. And in a letter to the chairman, I mentioned some examples in Alaska. There was one involving Valdez Fisheries Department Association, which is a nonprofit operating a fish hatchery in Valdez. They filed for bankruptcy when they faced a $2.1 million judgment from a failed real estate transaction. Now, the bankruptcy court found that the defendant had pursued all options in lieu of bankruptcy. The judges can, in Alaska, as you know, exercise some discretion with these appeal bonds, but they didn't in that case. The appeal bond, as I understand it in Alaska, is equal to the amount of the judgment. Another example was Nome Commercial, where two individuals declared bankruptcy after two judgments totaling $1.5 million. The bankruptcy court noted uncontradicted evidence that the debtors lacked the ability to post a bond, which would force the demise of their business while their case was pending before the Alaska Supreme Court. And finally, and I may not pronounce this right, so I ask your indulgence, Askinuk Corporation, which is a Native Village corporation whose shareholders were several hundred Native Alaskans, declared bankruptcy when it couldn't obtain a bond on a smaller judgment, $231,000. Due to the size of the judgment and the corporation's lack of liquidity, Askinuk was in no position to rely on 204D, which grants the court's discretion to reduce a required appeal bond. And I will not take the time of the committee to give examples from other states, but this has occurred throughout the United States, and that's why some version of ALEC's appeal bond reform, and I'd be pleased to give you the list, is now law in 37 states. Six states don't have an appeal bond requirement, so there aren't really that many states now that do not put some limit on appeal bonds. The way the bill before the committee works is to allow the judge discretion to set an appeal bond, but he or she has a limit for the total amount of the bond being $5 million or 10% of the net worth of the company. Now, when I worked on this legislation a long time ago and worked on helping to create it, I wanted to go to the reason for the rule. And for that reason, we put in an exception if a plaintiff can show by the preponderance of the evidence that there's a likelihood that the defendant on appeal might dissipate assets. And to the best of our knowledge, in all the states that have appeal bond legislation so far, there's never been a situation where some plaintiff later ended up being disappointed. What has happened is when there is an unfair judgment, unfair rulings, a very, very high verdict, and it happens once in a while, the defendant is able to appeal. And this is particularly important for defendants that may not be so popular. On the top of the Supreme Court, it says equal justice under law. And an unpopular defendant, as well as a popular one, as a practical matter, ought to have his or her right to appeal. And that's the purpose of the legislation. I do think it's sound. It has worked in other states. There's been no state that has ever repealed an appeal bond reform. So Alaska has the benefit of seeing these 37 other laboratories where it's worked. And I think those who have introduced it, Representative Coghill, and others who are co-sponsors, I commend them for doing it because it's fair legislation. My final point is that it doesn't set any caps on damages. It doesn't limit damages. Sometimes people get confused on that. It just helps assure that economic obstacles do not impede a person's right to appeal. And I thank you.
Are there questions for Mr. Schwartz?
Yeah, I have a couple.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did read the bill packet, and I saw in here plenty of places where there was a discussion that 35 other states have done something similar. But one of the other parts of the packet was a list from the American Tort Reform Association, which lists a whole bunch of state reforms. But all the numbers I'm seeing in these states are capping at $100 million, $50 million, $25 million. So looking at the sponsor statement and looking at hearing the testimony, it makes it sound like we're just going from being maybe one of the least restrictive or you know, most open, requiring the largest bonds, to just getting in line with other states. But can you tell us more about how this proposed language would line up? Because looking at the stuff in the bill packet, it looks like the language we have in front of us would go from being one of the most lax to being one of the absolute most restrictive.
Oh, nice. Representative Mr. Schwartz.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, most of the other bond limits are higher. You're correct. And that, if it is lower, it gives more people, like the case with the 15,000 verdict, an opportunity to appeal. So there's a risk benefit here. 231,000, excuse me. You, on one hand, if you have an appeal bond limit, yes, it would be lower than the amount set in most states. That's true. But if it is lower, then more people can benefit from it, and the amount to be fixed is something that to be determined by your committee.
So if I may follow up, Mr. Chairman, so what I'm understanding is, if passed, this would put us at one of the absolute most restrictive jurisdictions.
Well, you are a lawyer, right?
I can tell you the way
you speak. I like that. It would depends how you look at restriction. It would allow more people to benefit from the bill, but it certainly would be lower than other states. That's correct, Representative Holmes.
Okay, thank you. That actually was my question, and better, worse, lax, more, yeah, lower is probably the correct terminology. Higher versus lower, I think, is where I really wanted to get at. But this would be one of the lowest limits in the country.
That's correct, Representative Holmes. But I like lawyers because they, when they use words and everything, it's fun. I used to be a law professor, so I love the law. So I like to see restrictive versus lower. It's fun. Somebody was a lawyer, I think, said, depending on what is. I remember that. Some famous person talked about that. I think he was a lawyer.
Well, this is the chairman, Mr. Schwartz, and I don't like lawyers.
with all due respect. The past.
I try my best, and you all can make a judgment, not to talk like one, but just to use regular common sense words. I really try to do that. I don't always succeed, Mr. Chairman.
You're doing very well. It's Valdez. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In previous debates that we've had in previous legislatures, the appeal bonds that other states have done had to do with government, where the government is a party, which this bill does not cover, and it was mostly dealing with the tobacco settlement, which I know that the tobacco industry attempted to limit the appeal bonds in that particular instance, and it was rejected by that legislature, I believe, two legislatures ago, and that appeal bond limit was rejected, but those were the limits that we're talking about in there, but the government was a party to those. It was not a similar bill the way that I'm reading the sponsors to.
Well, through the chair, that's correct, Representative Samuels. The beginning of a lot of these bills being passed did stem in part from the situations with tobacco, but they resolved their government cases. And this is now something that is of interest to small businesses, large businesses, and government, I think, is excluded from this bill. They also exclude certain environmental situations that are very important to the state. And as I've said, when ALEC did its bill, it's a model bill, and it's up to legislatures to decide in their jurisdictions what's needed, but government is not under this bill.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor, you, I gather, are quite familiar with appeals in these types of cases, and that's your practice, is that right?
Through the chair, I just would say when anybody calls me professor, I get nervous. So, but I know you're being gracious. I'm familiar with appeals, yes.
Okay. Is it not true that plaintiffs often have far less resources than the defendants? You were concerned about the defendants going bankrupt. What is the rate of bankruptcy among plaintiffs pending this drawn-out litigation?
Well, that's an interesting question, through the chair, Representative Grunberg. The plaintiffs are not subject to appeal bonds at all. They may have their own circumstances where they have problems, but I, at least in the cases I've been involved in, when cases have some value and the plaintiff loses, the plaintiff discusses this with his or her attorney who's on a contingency fee. And at least when I practiced for the 14 years I did plaintiff's work, if there was a verdict where we really thought it was absolutely wrong, where the judge had made serious errors of law, we appealed it. We were on a contingency fee, and I would make a judgment, my best judgment, as to whether there could be a recovery.
Mr. Schwartz, I'm not being rude, but we're on a time limit here. Are you aware of the effect of a unique court rule we have in this state, Alaska Civil Rule 82?
Is this the rule that gives the judge discretion to lower the bond?
No, it is not.
Okay, could you share with me what it is?
It provides that the losing party in a case bears a portion of the winner's attorney's fees. And if a plaintiff loses, generally the standard is, and it's after trial, the standard is that the plaintiff must pay 30% of the defendant's actual attorney's fees, which can be very great, plus all of their costs, and there's a judgment entered against that plaintiff, just the same as if the plaintiff had prevailed. And the defendant, unless the plaintiff gets a supersedious bond, pending the appeal, the defendants customarily execute on the plaintiff and regularly cause plaintiffs in this state to go into bankruptcy or forego their appeals. Are you aware of those facts, sir?
Through the chair, no, I'm not.
Would that change your testimony, assuming what I've said is correct?
No, it would not. If there is problems with unfairness to plaintiffs, that's something that you and your domain can decide, whether these things are actually enforced against plaintiffs or not. But it wouldn't change my testimony because I know that appeal bond situations can be such that a person who has suffered a verdict that is really unlawful, not constitutional, has a problem sometimes taking an appeal. I know it's occurred. It has occurred. If there's a problem with plaintiffs, Representative Grunenberg, that should be dealt with by your committee.
And are you aware that the normal rule in this state since the so-called, quote, tort reform took place about 20 years ago has been that the plaintiffs don't receive their money in a lump sum but receive periodic payments? Were you aware of that being the law in this state?
I am Representative Grunenberg. I am not aware of that. I prepared for this testimony in regard to the bill that was before the committee. If a tort reform is doing harm or creates serious problems, that is something for the committee to address.
Are you aware of whether there's been, my third area of questioning, Mr. Chair, are you aware of a recent change in practice in the insurance industry where they look at these cases on a macro basis rather than a micro basis, and there is a far greater likelihood that, particularly in the insurance industry, the defendants in many of these cases would rather litigate an appeal to draw the cases out and dissuade the plaintiffs and the plaintiff's bar from litigating these cases and require them either to settle or go away? Are you aware of that change in the practice in the insurance industry?
It does not occur in this jurisdiction. So as far as I know, in Virginia and Maryland or the District of Columbia, those are the districts, the areas where I'm more aware of. And if it's something that's occurring in your state, that would seem to be a matter that should be considered.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Are you aware of whether that has occurred elsewhere in the country? As I am told by my friends at the plaintiff's bar, I'm just a family lawyer myself, but the plaintiff's bar tells me that that's the practice here in Alaska. Are you aware of whether that occurs elsewhere rather than Maryland?
No, but if it's needed, I will, at the request of the chair, look into it. But, you know, if I hear something from the defense bar or the plaintiff's bar, having been on both sides of the aisle, I always want to investigate and find out whether that's actually so. We're told a lot of things, but it's a matter that if the chair would want, I would look into. Otherwise, the committee should.
And finally, one final question. I talked with some of the folks who represent the lobbyists who represent the people who are seeking this legislation, and they gave me the sheet that lists those three cases that you mentioned a few minutes ago, and I had them. I asked them to find out for me the details of those three cases, and I was just informed a few minutes prior to the hearing that in those cases, none of the appellants challenged the court rule and indicated that this would cause them problems. I hope that I don't see the person who told me that here in the room, but I hope that I am quoting that correctly. I can't seem to find those three cases, but I know I did have them.
I've got the sites here if you need them.
Yeah.
I've got the In Re Valdez Fisheries is 5 ABR 406, and that's in bankruptcy court in Alaska in 1998.
Yeah, I've got this thing. We should have this. It says NFIB up at the top and Alaska. But those three cases that I'm aware, I was just told by one of the lobbyists that the courts came out with orders in these cases, but those orders themselves were not challenged. And under the, I practice appeals as well as family law, I did.
Okay.
That you can, in this state, appeal the ruling on a bond, and that would take place in the context of the main appeal. You go before the judge, you ask for a bond. If the judge denies your motion, you can take a motion, and that would go to a single justice on the court, and you can appeal that for reconsideration to the five members of the court. So you can have a specific ruling, and if they really didn't consider it, you can ask for reconsideration. So you can actually litigate that, and I was told in none of these three cases was that done. Do you know
Do you know, Representative Gruenberg, whether the judge has to automatically stay that? Because in other states where problems have arisen, where you can actually appeal an excessive appeal bond when there's some room for that, of the failure of the judge to exercise discretion, there isn't, there's no automatic stay. So a judge who is hostile to a particular defendant, and if you've practiced law, you go into courts, and sometimes, for one reason or another, a judge doesn't like a party. It can be a plaintiff or a defendant. He won't grant the stay, and you can appeal, but you have to put up the appeal bond pending your appeal. You're still in the same situation.
I see what you're saying. You're saying that there would have to be a motion for a stay of that until you could appeal the bond issue.
Right. Exactly, sir.
I think, I don't know, but I think that the court, the higher court, would take that issue very quickly and would think very unkindly of a trial judge who wouldn't do that to give you time to do that. There's a case called Powell versus the City of Anchorage where that was. Rule 62C, you can get an injunction pending appeal or review, and that deals with this. You got it to bring it to the Superior Court, but if they deny it, you can take that immediately to the Supreme Court. So, you know, the courts around here may treat people a little differently than they do elsewhere.
Well, that's, you know, in Illinois, the scenario that I've put forward for you, Representative Gruenberg, occurred, and what I know about that, I do know years and years ago I did family law, and that was the hardest thing I ever did, because they would call me at night, midnight, and so I don't know whether they do that in Alaska, but
well,
I decided that was too difficult.
Most family lawyers don't list their phone numbers. I always did, but the rule was they only got one call.
I like that.
Thank you, Governor.
I should have done that. I wish I knew you then.
Representative Hogan.
I would have established a one-call rule.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sympathetic to that, but the fact is, in this particular case, is the situation where they maybe could have put forth an appeal, the cost was going to be so high to begin with, I think that to challenge the court rule at that point even ratchets up a little further. So I think the reason for court rule change is even evident in that discussion. So,
thank you, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have another little series of questions here. How would this work? So you have a judgment, and then it goes up on appeal. And then how is it that you actually determine the appellant's net worth?
Well, there are materials that come before the court to try to show its assets and its liabilities, and the court can require that. And then from looking at its assets and its liabilities, the court determines its net worth. That's the way it's worked in other states.
If I may just continue following up,
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just for what it's worth, I'll give you a statutory cite on that, Representative Holm. That's it'll be 2190 934C, and I can pass the book around to you.
You could what? Yeah, that'd be great.
Maybe we could get that copied.
That'd be great. So they look at that, and does the other side have an opportunity to question that?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, my understanding is in other states, yes, they do.
Okay, I guess we'll wait for the statute to be copied to figure out what happens in our side. So in a lot of these cases, there might be insurance policies at play. Why wouldn't we, at the very least, make it go up to the limits of the insurance policy?
Well, that's a very good question. It depends on the local rules whether you know what the limits are. In this jurisdiction, you wouldn't really know what the limits are on the insurance policies.
Mr. Chair, and under the rules of discovery in this state,
Grimberg,
they have to disclose that.
So they would have to disclose that?
Absolutely.
Representative Grimberg, Representative Holmes.
Okay, so that would be, I guess I'll have to wait for the assets test to come around to see whether or not insurance policies are calculated in the assets.
Matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, in that definition, it starts off with insurance, and then it gives a little calculation.
Okay. Thank you. I'll just wait to see that. So why wouldn't we? I think I saw this in one of the other states. I think they said that one of the other states had something where it actually makes the party against whom the judgment's been entered, it makes them prove hardship. I understand there are some things we're talking about here that are huge judgments that are going to bankrupt the company. But I would think that they would be able to show that. You've got other cases, though. This would apply to smaller judgments. This would apply to, you know, a car accident or, you know, things like that where it's a much lower amount. And I'm concerned that 10% of your net worth, I'm just going to run you down a little hypothetical here, where you've got somebody who might have a really good job, but they might have a really big, they might have one of those zero down mortgages on their house where they really don't have a lot of equity in the house. They might have some credit card bills. They might have this and that. They might have a good income stream, but their actual net worth is very little or even negative. And so basically, automatically under this, they don't have to post any bond at all, even though they might have a really good job. They might have a six-figure job.
Is this a question you're directing to Mr. Schwartz?
Yeah, it's a question of why is that true under this case, and is there some good way to address that? Because I'm worried about that sort
Thank
of
you,
case.
Mr. Schwartz?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, in situations of that kind, I think the greatest concern would be that the person won't have any assets at all to satisfy the judgment, or the person may do things so that they're not satisfied. The bill protects against that. To the best of my knowledge, again, this is other states, that hasn't been a problem. When the appeal bond statutes kick in, it's with companies and businesses, dry cleaners, beauty parlors, or big businesses, pharmaceutical companies, not so much, you know, auto cases or things of that kind. That's all I can share with you in terms of my experience.
But wouldn't it be true under here that that the appeal would be, I mean, that the bond would be set at zero under the law? I mean, it's set at the lesser of 10% of your net.
Right. If there was a person that had absolutely no net worth, zero net worth, that would occur, yes.
Despite possibly having a...
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Despite having the ability to pay because they have a good... I mean, they could have a good job. They could be employed. They could have an income stream, but their actual net worth, the way it's calculated, is...
Well, that's in through the chair, Representative Holmes. That's a very interesting hypothetical. I've never...
Mr. Schwartz, I need to interrupt you for a second. I'm big on decorum, and it's appropriate to say through the chair, Representative Holmes, and I let it slide for the last 15 minutes, but I want to make...
Oh, okay. Yeah, I need your help on...
You're good.
As I say, I've never been... So you say through the chair, and then... Her name?
And then direct your question to Representative
Holmes. Oh, may or direct your question. Okay.
Correct.
So I say, through the chair, may I direct your question to?
through the chair, Representative Holmes, and it's Valdez. We get you used to Alaska because you should visit here.
Your last name?
Huh? Well, I visited there once on a ship, and I went to some place called Skagway. Yeah. And then a classmate of mine, Ron Birch, practices there.
I know.
And then I had a friendship, and I've heard that maybe, I don't know whether he's with us anymore, Justice Jay Lefkowitz, when I taught at Cincinnati, I knew him and corresponded with him.
Jay Rabinowitz?
Rabinowitz, I'm sorry.
Jay is gone, but the courthouse in Fairbanks is named after him, and he was a good friend of my
family. He was a great man. He moved there from Philadelphia. He said he would never move back, and he was very kind to me when I was I was a 32-year-old dean at Cincinnati Law School, and he was very kind to me.
Mr. Schwartz,
but,
he was kind to everybody that he ever met. He was a great man.
And
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Max Gruenberg. Ron Birch is good friend of mine. If you think, please say hello.
Thank you, and same.
Question. I want to try and stay on task today, Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, the famous cases, Mr. Schwartz, that you would recall, where they had a fleet of yellow cabs. And they incorporated each cab separately, so if these cabs got into an accident, all you'd get is the value of the one taxi cab. That was a California case, as I recall. If we use the appellant's network, and you're suing a valid corporation, and the corporation consists of a yellow cab, then under this bill, all you'd get is the fair market value of a beat-up yellow cab, isn't that correct, as the bond?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, do I have it right?
Yes, sir, you do. Thank you, Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg, through the chair. that's one I would have to think about. Certainly, if I were a trial judge here, I would be troubled with that one. So all I can answer is that it's a... If that type of practice was used, I would want to make sure that under the law as it's written, that the net worth of the company as a whole would be the thing that would be considered, not individual, you know, breaking up into individual cabs. Again, it's something that I have never heard of in other jurisdictions.
Gene. Thank you, and I can see you're a man that honors justice.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you. This is
Representative Coghill.
Thank you.
Mine was taken up with Representative Gruenberg, so.
Yeah, we were looking at the definition of net worth, and yeah, I thank you.
Representative Holmes?
If I may, I don't see net worth defined anywhere on this page. It defines policy or policyholder surplus, but I don't see the word net worth, and I'm looking in that section.
Madam Chair.
Representative Coghill?
That was the I had Ledge Legal look for me where that was defined, and that was the only calculation that we had available in statute.
I may be able to respond.
Representative Gruenberg.
If the folks would look at number 34, policy surplus means, and then this doesn't directly relate, but under capital C, it's talking about an insurer other than a various types of insurer, the net worth would be calculated as its recorded assets less its liabilities as determined by certain accounting criteria in the insurance code. But I think what Representative Coghill is talking about is it's the concept of assets less liabilities is net worth. That's the general idea that he's getting at here.
So let me explain the intention of the chair today. I have a commitment shortly after 3 o'clock. The goal of this chair is to hear House Bill 400 from the minority leader, and I hope that is a goal that is shared by members of the Judiciary Committee. My intention is to wind our way through House Bill 103 and give it the appropriate amount of time and analysis that it requires. We do have somebody from the Department of Law available for questions. We have two other people that want to testify from the NFIB, and for the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. So clearly, they'll have a point of view, but they won't have the same content that Mr. Schwartz will be able to provide us. But that is my objective today, is to hear, and I intend to move the minority leader's bill, and we're going to take up that bill after we take up House Bill 103, and we're going to conclude our affairs today shortly after 3 o'clock. So with that said, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question goes more to where and how we define net worth, and since I'm not sure that's an appropriate question for Mr. Schwartz, I'll hold it until we get to maybe Department of Law.
And Mr. Schwartz, if he can stay with us, we will have him stay with us through all of the testimony and be available on this bill. Are there other questions for Mr. Schwartz? Representative Broomberg.
I have a question for the sponsor at some point.
Okay.
At some point, and I'm sorry if I missed this, I don't think I did, but at some point I'd like you or Karen or somebody, Ms. Lidster, to walk us through the differences between the CS and the original bill, because there are some fair differences at some point.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be willing to do that, but I wanted to have the discussions. I wanted to kind of break out with Mr. Schwartz available for testimony, because I thought he could probably do a much better job at getting to the root of the liability issue than I could. And so with that, I know the limits are going to be one of the questions, and then the differences between versions and or our existing court rules right now. So I was kind of hoping to get those questions brought up to the surface with the idea of answering them before I come back before the committee again.
Representative Groenberg.
Just one thing. I see we have the defense bar and defendants represented here. I would hope that when we take the bill up next, we'd give the ABLA lawyers a chance to be heard on this in the plaintiff's bar.
You are missing my intention, Mr. Groenberg, unless it's the wishes of the bill sponsor. My objective is to move this freight along, as I am mindful of the clock. Today is March 12th, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So are there more questions for Mr. Schwartz? All right, seeing none, if you'll stand by, Mr. Schwartz, we thank you very much for your expert testimony on this issue. I will remind the committee that Jane Johnson from the Department of Law is available to answer questions. Is Michael Wilson here, please, from the NFL?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Thank you. You've been a pleasure, and thank you for remembering Jay Rabinowitz. I appreciate that. Is Mr. Wilson here? Mr. Wilson, if you'll introduce yourself and any affiliation you have for the record, please.
I'm Michael Wilson. I'm with Coastal Helicopters, representing NFIB.
Welcome.
Never done anything like this, but in relation to this bill, I think, you know, the limits on the appeal bond definitely would enable my...
You got just black. We're so happy to have you. There's a difference between an expert witness and somebody who comes from the communities.
Right.
Just,
we don't fight.
We're so happy. We're so happy you're here.
As a small business, I mean, If I were to try to get a bond for what I thought was a wrong judgment or an illegal judgment or however a large number, it could possibly put my company out of business, and that's, you know, 20 to 25 full-time jobs in Juneau plus, you know, associated seasonal positions. Because I'm in the aviation business, you know, the people see the deep pockets, and, you know, a civil litigation would, it all rolls downhill, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm working on margin anyway, and then I have to go out and bring this large bond so I can appeal this judgment. It would be detrimental.
Well, it's widely known that after oil and gas, aviation is probably the most profitable in the state of Alaska. That's widely understood by many of us on this committee. Can you take us through? You're welcome, Representative Samuels. He's a Pan Air executive.
Sir, that was aimed at me, not at you.
he's a Pan Air executive. A hypothetical aviation example to show us what kind of acute pressure this would put on your organization, please.
A hypothetical example would
Or a real-life one, whichever is more appropriate.
Well, say something were to happen, and there was damage to somebody's property, and, you know, the property's only worth so much, and I could understand a judgment for the actual damages, but then there would be the civil damages on top of that that could be huge, because somebody feels like their ego was hurt, and they think that they should be able not only to have the damages repaired, but also be able to build a mansion on top of that property. And in order to get a bond to match what their damages is, the damages that they believe are, it would take my business that is, you know, working from day to day and you know, making sure I'm paid. And then all of a sudden I've got to come up with this large sum of money to appeal this damages. And so I'm stuck liquidating my assets, trying to meet it. I'm laying people off. So there's people that are out jobs. And realistically, I could end up filing bankruptcy and being out of work myself and trying to, and then nobody gets anything.
For protecting yourself from a contingent liability, from in order just to be able to defend yourself.
Correct.
Private sector. Mm-hmm. I'm with you. I'm a small business person also. I understand the vice chair and her spouse run a small business also, and a lot of empathy around this table for precisely what you're talking about. Representative Greenberg, do you have a question?
Thank you. Actually, lawyers have a small business too, most of us, and we probably don't have as many assets in our business as you do. You're mainly looking at what would happen. I gather you have an airline or an air charter service or something like that?
Exactly, yeah.
Are you covered by insurance?
Yes, sir.
And if they sue you, then the insurance company defends you, doesn't it?
That's correct.
And if there's an appeal, the insurance company puts up the bond, don't they?
To a degree, yes.
Mr. Wilson, if you could just direct your responses to the chair.
I'm sorry. My
appropriate
department.
We want.
I'm sorry.
And you're doing a good job, though. We appreciate real-life people coming into the community. It's just appropriate to say through the chair, Representative Grunberg, and then we're doing good.
I do apologize.
Thank you very much, Representative Grunberg.
Through the chair. So the insurance company normally would put up the bond, and it would be based on the amount of the judgment. Are you anxious for your competitors to know what your business's assets are worth?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, no, I'm not.
If you look at the bill, maybe we can get a copy of the bill here. The amount of the bond is the lesser of $5 million or 10% of the appellant's net worth. So in order to get the bond, if this bill passes, you will have to file in court your net worth, your company's net worth. That will become a public document. Your competitors will be able to see that. Right now, the bond is based on the amount of the judgment, and it's put up by the insurance company. Do you think if you had to disclose your net worth to appeal the case, that might give your competitors some kind of information they don't have now that you wouldn't want them to have? Through the chair?
Through the chair, Senator Grunberg. I don't believe so. I don't think it would make any difference. I mean, they would have an idea as to my assets and the net worth. I don't think it would give my competitors any advantage.
May I rephrase the question?
Yes, if you would, and then I'd like to direct the same question. You're doing such a great job, Mr. Wilson. Thank you very much. I'd like to also direct the question to Mr. Schwartz and see what his point of view is on it all.
Of course.
Would you please
Would you like this information to be disclosed as a condition of your taking the appeal, basically, through the chair to you, Mr. Wilson? I'm looking here. If you look at the bill, it's on page 2, lines 3 and 4.
Through the chair. I know where you're talking about, the $5 million or 10% of the net worth. I understand that.
The lesser.
The lesser of.
Gentlemen.
Through the chair.
Thank you.
Sorry. I've been on this committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Long.
Representative Coghill.
Could we have Mr. Schwartz give a view of that particular scenario?
Yes.
As it might apply to the various different states that he knows of.
Yes, Mr. Schwartz, did you hear that exchange between Mr. Wilson?
Yes, I did.
Greenberg? Thank you. If you'll comment on that, please.
In some states, that material is given to the court under seal the same way other materials, for example, a trade secret, would be given to the court.
Thank you. Representative Greenberg?
Just that's not what this bill provides.
All right. Perhaps it's something we can remedy through an amendment. Are there other questions for Mr. Wilson? Mr. Wilson, thank you for taking time out of your day. This committee and this building, we value so much. Real people, real businesses coming down here to offer genuine testimony. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. I hope you have a great season. All right. Next, we have... Wayne Stevens is with us telephonically from the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. Wayne?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wayne Stevens. I'm President and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. Being respectful of your time constraints, as you've noted, I'd call your attention to our letter that's in your packet. Suffice it to say, the Alaska State Chamber supports House Bill 103, which limits the size of appeal bonds as both sides work through the court process. Court reform has long been a priority of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, and we feel that House Bill 103 is a right step in creating a better appeal process for keeping businesses whole while ensuring wronged defendants access to a solvent company. Thank you.
Are there questions for Mr. Stevens? Is there anyone else here in the room that would like to testify? Do we have anybody else online? Are there any questions for Ann? Johnson with the Department of Law, or this here? Ann, are you here?
I do have a question.
Ann, could you come up here, please? Thank you.
Me too, actually.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, I'm Ann Johnson with the Department of Law.
Welcome. We're so happy to have you here before the committee. Representative Greenberg.
Ms. Johnson, I note that the CS contains an additional provision that wasn't, at least one that wasn't in the original bill. It's found on page 2, lines 11 and 12, that exempts actions or proceedings in which the state or another governmental entity is a party. And I presume that is to protect the state and other governmental entities when they prevail. It enables the state sword to pierce through this, and it's not a shield to protect the state. Why did the state feel it was unjust when the state's a plaintiff that the state would be under this? Why shouldn't other people be given the same break the state is?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, I don't have a response when you compare the state. You're correct in saying the state is an appellee, and this is meant as an appellee in this language. I do not have a response in comparing the state to the general consumer, general business person. We didn't have that discussion. If there were those discussions, I was not privy to them.
May I ask one more follow-up?
Yes, Representative Greenberg.
The state is saying if we prevail and we're the appellee, then we can require the normal bond to be put up.
That's correct.
So obviously the state didn't feel it was fair that the state should be so limited, right?
That's an inference that you are drawing, and yes, it is correct that the state favors the language that is listed on lines 11 and 12.
Were you part of the negotiations when that language was put into the CS?
I've been part of some limited discussions regarding that language.
Through the chair, just one final question. I gather you didn't think it was fair that the state should be so limited. Am I correct? You being the Department of Law.
As a member of the Department of Law, yes, I'm in favor of the language on lines 11 and 12.
Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions. First is, Where can we find net worth defined in statute?
It's not defined in this statute, and I would have to get back to you on where it is defined in other statutes. That's not something that we researched.
Okay, so we don't have any idea really what this does, because we don't know how to calculate net worth.
Well, I think it would be easy to do a search to determine if the definition is present in other statutes. I haven't done that.
But at this point, we don't know
how
it's defined or whether it's defined at all.
No, we don't. It's not here.
Okay. That's okay. That's concern number one.
Mr. Chairman, just on that particular point, in doing business all over this state, people are talking about their net worth. And there are CPAs that talk about net worth all day long. And the simple calculation I brought out in the statute is very clear that assets and liabilities are part of the formula for net worth. So to say that they're not defined anywhere, or to infer from the Department of Law that net worth is not attainable, I think is incorrect.
And that's not what I testified to, that it's not obtainable.
Johnson?
Representative Coghill.
You sure left that opinion, Mr. Chairman.
Please repeat that, Representative.
She sure left the opinion, or somebody left the opinion, that it could not be described or attained through the statute.
Who are you directing it to, Ms. Johnson or Representative?
Ms. Johnson.
Okay. There's no definition within the statute of net worth. Okay. Are there common definitions of net worth? Are there various ways to define net worth? Yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was left with a distinct opinion between the two conversations that it could not be arrived at, and I just so object.
Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, my impression at this point is not that we know for a fact that it's not defined, but that we do not know how it is defined or if it's defined at this point. Is that satisfactory?
Mr. Chairman, I understand the line of questioning is to try to poke holes through this, but to say that we could not find a net worth of an individual company, I think, is not very good discussion to go down that road. If we have to define that in every statute that ever talks about it, I think we're running down a wrong road. So just for what it's worth.
Thank you, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remain concerned that sitting here in judiciary right now, I do not know how it will be defined for purposes of this statute, and I would like to know how it is defined. That's my concern, is that I don't know when looking at this what it means. My second question has to do with the inclusion or exclusion of appeals costs and interest. We have kind of three different places here, several different places here, where we are changing the court rules. And it seems like now what you have is the bond is posted in the amount of the judgment plus appeal costs and interest. And it says, in my reading, that is now limited to $5 million or 10% of the net worth, but then there are exceptions for that. For instance, if somebody is dissipating assets. And if they're dissipating assets, then it says that they have to post a bond in the amount. And for instance, I'm looking on page 2, line 8 is one of the places where it says the appellant then posts a bond in the amount up to the full amount of the judgment. But it does not allow the appeals costs and interest to be added back in. That's both there, and then I found it again on page 4, line 10. So if somebody's dissipating assets and you want to reinstate the full bond, we aren't really reinstating the full bond under the way this is written, because appeals costs and interest are still excluded. Was that intentional?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, to my knowledge, that was not intentional.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That might be something we might want to take up.
Okay. Representative Grunberg?
I do. I'm sorry.
Oh, I had a couple other questions, but they were on slightly different topics.
Could I maybe
on points, Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, and I apologize for the sidebar here, and the question's been answered. Please just tell me to shut up. Ms. Johnson, I gather you're in the tort section?
No. Representative Grunberg, through the chair, you could get that impression when I'm up here testifying to this bill. I'm in oil and gas.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine.
Oil and gas, my favorite section.
Can we go back to 410? No. that was a bill we had the other day. The question of net worth, from a litigator's point of view, if the question was whether $5 million was more or less than 10% of the appellant's net worth, might that not involve a trial within a trial? How complicated would that be to decide that question?
Through the chair.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, that may depend on how you would define net worth.
Well, even suppose we defined it, might that not involve considerable proof?
In the realm of possibility, yes. Could it lead to a dispute over which is greater? Possibly.
And if so, if it were that, you know, indisputably, the 10% was less than $5 million, the court would have to make a factual finding, in effect, as to what the appellant's net worth was. Would it not, and might that not be a fairly complicated thing? I know in family law it's pretty tough sometimes to find what a family's net worth is.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, yes, your scenario is foreseeable.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up in a similar vein, there is the exception I was talking about. If the appellee, no, if the appellee, yeah, if it, they prove that somebody is, if the, that the appellant is dissipating assets. How do you prove, how do you go about figuring that out? What rights of discovery would be, if I have to prove by preponderance of the evidence that the other party is dissipating their assets, what rights do I have in finding that? Do I have rights of discovery? Do I have rights of subpoena? How does that work?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, I think that that's a good question. I think we don't know yet because this isn't the law in this state, so it hasn't been played out. One example would be that there would be a hearing. The burden of proof is spelled out in this in the bill, preponderance of the evidence, the tipping of the scales. It would probably involve discovery of the income statements, balance sheets, things of that nature. But I can't say from experience, because again, this is a bill. It hasn't been the law.
Through the chair, would this need to be spelled out here, or
could you clarify?
Through the chair, do you think that having it the way it is right now, that just says they have to prove by preponderance of the evidence, but doesn't give any other guidance as to burdens, discovery rights or procedure or anything, is this sufficient, or is this going to be confusing?
I just want to take a moment and read the sentence. Representative Holmes, through the chair, this is something that could possibly be made clearer through regulations. It's like a lot of things. It does give the burden of proof. It does not discuss whether it would be in the what type of forum the issue would be held in, if it's in the form of a hearing, if it's in front of the same judge. So is there a lack of clarity? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, just on the court rule talks about when the on appeal, the court is considering the petitioner's view. So the court already has this under consideration, if I am understanding it correctly. So it would be either some kind of a further hearing or a separate hearing based on the appeal.
Representative Coghill, through the chair, yes, it would be some type of.
Right.
As you said, so what that is, I can't answer.
I think what I'm hearing Representative Holmes say is that somehow it would leave the jurisdiction of that particular court, and I don't think it would because it's an appeal under this rule. So I guess I've been in enough of your kind of cases in family law where they do either a furtherance or they do assign another hearing to a particular aspect. So it wouldn't seem unreasonable to me that they would do that in this particular case for that discovery.
Yes, that's quite possible.
Yeah, so.
Representative Holmes, then Gruenberg.
Well, I had one more question, but before that, I was just wondering, do we happen to have anybody from the court system available, since these are court rules that we're discussing?
I beg your pardon, I'm sorry.
I have one additional other question, but I was just wondering, since we're talking about how courts are going to interpret these rules, do we have anybody from the court system available, since we're discussing court rule amendments?
Had not contemplated that, only because of the hundreds of bills that I've done through this legislature that contemplated court rules. We never asked the court to come testify on that court rule.
I quite agree.
I take it as
Representative Gruenberg.
Sorry. Pardon me? I'm sorry.
I did have one other question, actually. Okay. But I took that as a no, we do not.
That is correct.
Okay. Applicability section, which is at the bottom of page 4, lines 23 and 24. It says the act applies to cases that are pending on or filed on or after the date this act becomes law. How would that be applied? Does that mean bills that are already up on appeal where bonds have already been posted could be reduced? Does it mean future bonds? Is this clear enough to be, what cases does this apply to and not apply to?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, I believe this language is fairly straightforward. This act applies to cases pending on or filed on or after the date. So if there's an action that's pending in the court system on or after the date this act becomes law, it would apply to it.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I may just follow up, does that means that things that are already up on appeal, would they go back and recalculate bonds that were already, I mean, if something's in the middle of an appeal and a bond had been posted, could we have a whole rash of people coming in and saying, I want to reduce my bond now? Could they under this? I
possibly.
Don't know the answer. Possibly. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Suppose there were cases filed, Ms. Johnson, in different courts or possibly in the same judicial district on basically the same subject. Let's say somebody's injured by some product of some type, or three people, parties A, B, and C. In case the first case, sue defendants 1, 2, and 3. In the second case, parties B, C, and D sue defendants 2, 3, and 4. In the third case, and I'm just going to make this so simple even I can understand this, C, D, and E sue defendants 3, 4, and 5. And then
in different districts or jurisdictions within Alaska, are you talking about a national class action?
One is Judge Collins and the other is Judge Pallenberg, okay. Or it could be, you know, whatever.
Okay.
they're not consolidated.
All right.
But they go up on appeal. And either they are or are not consolidated on appeal, because the Supremes can consolidate them for the first time on an appeal. The language says the amount of the bond required collectively of all appellants may not exceed the lesser of $5 million or 10% of all appellants' net worth. how would this thing work when you've got all these plaintiffs, all these defendants, they're intermingled? How are the courts going to, for goodness sakes, figure this thing out?
I think the question would become, when it goes up on appeal, if the cases are combined, there is that issue, how you would interpret this language. If the cases go up on appeal, even if the issues are the same but they are separate cases, then I think you're looking at three separate cases and three separate analyses of net worth. And, you know, the $5 million versus the 10%.
But if they're consolidated, this could be kind of a tangled web.
It creates, Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, yes, it creates a question.
It'll lead to the development of interesting appellate law.
Indeed.
Okay. I apologize for
asking you to do the show with me.
I just got a note that Labor and Commerce is canceled. That opens up my schedule. What kind of time is available?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cockham?
I think we're scheduled for a floor session sometime around 3 o'clock.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So with that, Ms. Johnson, thank you very much for your help.
Thank you very much.
We're going to set this bill aside. Aurora, thank you for waiting patiently. Would you please come up? We want to take up House Bill 400.
What does that mean?
I'm going to start fighting back. Look at Black.
Oh, no, not consequences, as my niece would say to my uncle.
Hi, Aurora. Hi. I didn't have the pleasure of having you before our committee because I was absent last time. I understand that we brought this before the committee. If you would introduce yourself, just give us a brief overview and the changes or a reversion back to the original version of the bill. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aurora Hawk. I work for Representative Beth Curtula. The bill before you is House Bill number 400, version C. It's just the bill as introduced. It simply allows a mitigating factor for calling 911 and getting help for somebody who's experiencing an overdose.
May I interrupt you for a moment? Vice Chair Dahlstrom, did we adopt the CS for House Bill 400 version M, or did we just have it before us? Which version of the bill are we working off of? I know that we want to take up version C. I'm just wondering if we had version M before us.
The motion was made to adopt it, but the motion was withdrawn, and so it's not been adopted.
So we do have version C before us?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Go ahead, Rory.
It simply allows for a mitigating factor on drug charges if you call 911 to get help for somebody who isn't experiencing a drug overdose.
Are there questions for the bill sponsor? I will tell you, Representative Samuels, go ahead.
Thank you. I just thought of this question when you made the comment that way. What if they're not experiencing a drug overdose? Do you call, you think they are? Do you still get the mitigator?
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
Is it if they're not experiencing a drug overdose, but you think that they are, and you called 911, does the mitigator reply? And I don't.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, the way this is drafted, it does not look like it.
It does not look like it. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Are there other questions? I will just say for the record that my continued private sector experience with the professionals that I just had our chef here, and we've got some wonderful professionals, but I also deal with the bottom third of the labor pool, and we had a 20-year-old cashier that worked for us 2 weeks ago. She had a boyfriend who was rumored to be a drug dealer. He was high on something. She took him home to her parents' house, put him into bed. The next morning when she went to go wake him, he was dead in bed.
Mm.
So I draw on a wealth of tragic but real life experience over and over and over again. Today in the Daily News Miner, it was just revealed this drug informant, yeah, Fairbanks, was killed. His father was our maintenance man at Pike's Hotel. I told Senator Wagner, I think I'm going to go home and die this weekend because I got to go fire this maintenance man because he had a confrontation with airport troopers, because we had two young men from Fort Wainwright. They were throwing beer bottles into the Chena River, and he approached the troopers and said, I am in charge of security here at this property, and, you know, had a confrontation with the troopers. He was killed when he threatened the two fellows in jail that killed his son, who is today regarded as a drug informant. So these things are real. This happens with a very significant, very vulnerable part of our population that happens to bring a lot of their troubles upon themselves, but they are a burden that society has to deal with, and some can be saved. And I applaud the minority leader, and thank you, Aurora, for bringing something before us that lends itself to a helping hand for a group of folks that have a tough time. So I thank you for I thank you and the minority leader for bringing this bill to our attention. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to entertain a motion.
Yes.
I wish to move House Bill number 425-LS1518-C with attached physical note and individual recommendations.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 400 passes from committee. It's 3 o'clock, and we're adjourned.